days previous to the meeting of the American Bankers Association in New Orleans in 1911. There was not one banker in 100 who had read that bill. We had 12 addresses in favor of it. General Hamby of Austin, Texas, wrote a letter to President Watts asking for a hearing against the bill. He did not get a very courteous answer. I refused to vote on it, and a great many other bankers did likewise. They would not allow anyone on the program who was not in favor of the bill. It is interesting that during Frame's testimony, Congressman Glass refrained from commenting on the unfairness of allowing only one side of an issue to be heard in a public forum. He could hardly afford to. That is hardly what he was then doing with his own agenda. As the Federal Reserve Act moved closer to its birth in the form of the Glass-Owen bill, Owen was the co-sponsor in the Senate, both Aldrich and Vanderlip threw themselves into a great public display of opposition. No opportunity was overlooked to make a statement to the press, or anyone else of public prominence, expressing their eternal animosity to this monstrous legislation. Vanderlip warned against the evils of fiat money and rampant inflation. Aldrich charged that the Glass-Owen bill was inimical to sound banking and good government. Vanderlip predicted speculation and instability in the stock market. Aldrich sourly complained that the bill was revolutionary in its character, implying Bolshevistic, and will be the first and most important step toward changing our form of government from a democracy to an autocracy. The pretense is dropped. That all of this was merely high-level showmanship was made clear when Vanderlip accepted a debate with Congressman Glass before the New York Economic Society on November 13th. There were 1,100 bankers and businessmen present, and Vanderlip was under pressure to make a good showing before this impressive group. The debate was going badly for him, and in a moment of desperation he finally dropped the pretense. "For years," he said, "bankers have been almost the sole advocates of just this sort of legislation that is now hoped we will have, and it is unfair to accuse them of being in opposition to sound legislation." 22 years later, when the need for pretense had long passed, Vanderlip was even more candid. Writing in the Saturday Evening Post, he said, "Although the Aldrich Federal Reserve Plan was defeated when it bore the name Aldrich, nevertheless, its essential points were all contained in the plan that finally was adopted." In his autobiography, Treasury Secretary William McAdoo offers this view. "Bankers fought the Federal Reserve legislation and every provision of the Federal Reserve Act with the tireless energy of men fighting a forest fire. They said it was populistic, socialistic, half-baked, destructive, infantile, badly conceived, and unworkable." These interviews with bankers led me to an interesting conclusion. I perceived gradually, through all the haze and smoke of controversy, that the banking world was not really as opposed to the bill as it pretended to be. That is the key to this entire episode, mass psychology. Since Aldrich was recognized as associated with the Morgan interests and Vanderlip was president of Rockefeller's National City Bank, the public was skillfully led to believe that the Money Trust was mortally afraid of the proposed Federal Reserve Act. The Nation was the only prominent publication to point out that every one of the horrors described by Aldrich and Vanderlip could have been equally ascribed to the Aldrich bill as well. But this lone voice was easily drowned by the great cacophony of deception and propaganda. The Glass bill was a flexible document which was designed from the beginning to be altered in non-essential matters in order to appear as though compromises were being made to satisfy the various political factions. Since very few understood central bank technicalities, the ploy was easy to execute. The basic strategy was to focus debate on such relatively unimportant items as the number of regional banks, the structure of the governing board, and the process by which that board was to be selected. When truly crucial matters could not be avoided, The response was to agree to almost anything, but to write the provisions in vague language. In that way, the back door would be left ajar for later implementation of the original intent. The goal was to get the bill passed and perfect it later. House and Warburg feared that if they waited until they had everything they wanted, they would get nothing at all, or worse, that opponents of a central bank would be able to muster their forces and pass a reform bill of their own, a real one. Willis was quick to agree. In a letter to his former professor, he wrote, "It is much better to take a half a loaf rather than to be absolutely deprived of a chance of getting any bread whatsoever." The so-called progressive element, such as Lindbergh and his supporters, will be encouraged to enact dangerous legislation. Glass echoed the sentiment, directing his remarks at those smaller banks which were resisting domination by the New York banks. He said, "Unless the conservative bankers of the country are willing to yield something and get behind the bill, we shall get legislation very much less to be desired, or have nothing done at all." Bryan makes an ultimatum. The populist William Jennings Bryan was considered at that time to be the most influential Democrat in Congress, and it was clear from the start that the Federal Reserve Act could never be passed without his approval and support. As Charles Seymour observed, the commoner's sense of loyalty to the party had kept him from an attack upon the Federal Reserve Act, which it would appear he never entirely understood. With his influence in the party, he could have destroyed the measure which failed to accord with his personal doctrines. Bryan had said that he would not support any bill that resulted in private money being issued by private banks. The money supply, he insisted, must be government issue. When he finally saw an actual draft of the bill in midsummer of 1913, he was dismayed to find that not only was the money to be privately issued, but the entire governing body of the central bank was to be composed of private bankers. His ultimatum was not long in coming. He hotly demanded, 1. That the Federal Reserve notes must be treasury currency, issued and guaranteed by the government, and 2. That the governing body must be appointed by the president and approved by the Senate. Colonel House and the other monetary scientists were reasonably sure that these provisions eventually would be required for final approval of the bill, but, being master strategists, they deliberately withheld them from early drafts so they could be used as bargaining points and added later as concessions in a show of compromise. Furthermore, since practically no one really understood the technical aspects of the measure, they knew it would be easy to fool their opponents by creating the appearance of compromise when, in actual operation, the originally intended features would remain. An amazing revelation. The nature of this deception was spelled out years later by Carter Glass in his book Adventures in Constructive Finance. From this source, we learn that after Bryan had delivered his ultimatum, Glass was summoned to the White House and told by Wilson that the decision had been made to make the Federal Reserve notes obligations of the United States government. "I was for an instant speechless," wrote Glass, who then explained how he reminded the president that the only backing for the new currency would be a small amount of gold, a large amount of government and commercial debt, and the private assets of the individual banks themselves. "It would be a pretense on its face," he said. "Was there ever a government note based primarily on the property of banking institutions? Was there ever a government issue, not $1 of which could be put out except by demand of a bank? The suggested government obligation is so remote, it could never be discovered." To which the president replied, "Exactly so, Glass. Every word you say is true. The government liability is a mere thought. And so if we can hold the substance of the thing and give the other fellow the shadow, why not do it? If thereby we may save our bill." Years later, Paul Warburg would explain further. "While technically and legally the Federal Reserve note is an obligation of the United States government, In reality, it is an obligation, the sole actual responsibility for which rests on the reserve banks. The government could only be called upon to take them up after the reserve banks had failed. Warburg's explanation should be carefully analyzed. It is an incredibly important statement. The man who masterminded the Federal Reserve System is telling us that Federal Reserve notes constitute privately issued money with the taxpayers standing by to cover the potential losses of those banks which issue it. One of the more controversial assertions of this book is that the objectives set forth at the Jekyll Island meeting included the shifting of the cartel's losses from the owners of the banks to the taxpayers. Warburg himself has confirmed it. But let us return to the great deceit of 1913. The second demand made by Bryan, political control over the system, not banker control, was met with an equally beguiling compromise. In addition to the governing board of regional bankers previously proposed, there now would be a central regulatory commission to be called the Federal Reserve Board, appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. Thus, the public was to be protected through a sharing of power, a melding of interests, a system of checks and balances. In this way, said Wilson, the banks may be instruments, not the masters of business and of individual enterprise and initiative. The arrangement was heralded as a bold new experiment in representative government. In reality, it was but the return of the ancient partnership between the monetary and political scientists. The only thing new was that power was now to be shared openly in plain view of the public. But of course there would not be much to see. All the deliberations and most of the decisions were to happen behind closed doors. Furthermore, the division of power and responsibility between these groups was left deliberately vague. Without a detailed line of command or even a clear concept of function, it was inevitable that, as with the drafting of the bill itself, real power would gravitate into the hands of those with technical knowledge and Wall Street connections. To the monetary scientists drafting the bill and engineering the compromises, the eventual concentration of effective control into their hands was never in serious doubt. And as we shall see in the next chapter, subsequent events have proved the soundness of that strategy. Bryan endorses the bill. Bryan was no match for the Jekyll Island strategists, and he accepted the compromises at face value. Had there been any lingering doubts in his mind, they were swept away by gratitude for his appointment as Wilson's Secretary of State. Now that he was on the team, he declared, "I appreciate so profoundly the service rendered by the President to the people in the stand he has taken on the fundamental principles involved in currency reform, that I am with him in all the details. The right of the government to issue money is not surrendered to the banks. The control over the money so issued is not relinquished by the government. I am glad to endorse earnestly and unreservedly the currency bill as a much better measure than I supposed it possible to secure at this time. Conflicting opinions have been reconciled with a success hardly to have been expected." With the conversion of Bryan, there was no longer any doubt about the final outcome. The Federal Reserve Act was released from the Joint House and Senate Conference Committee on December 22, 1913, just as Congress was preoccupied with departure for the Christmas recess and in no mood for debate. It quickly passed by a vote of 282-60 in the House and 43-23 in the Senate. The president signed it into law the next day. The creature had swallowed Congress. Summary. President Taft, although a Republican spokesman for big business, refused to champion the Aldrich bill for a central bank. This marked him for political extinction. The Money Trust wanted a president who would aggressively promote the bill and the man selected was Woodrow Wilson, who had already publicly declared his allegiance. Wilson's nomination at the Democratic National Convention was secured by Colonel House, a close associate of Morgan and Warburg. To make sure that Taft did not win his bid for re-election, the Money Trust encouraged the former Republican President Teddy Roosevelt to run on the progressive ticket. The result, as planned, was that Roosevelt pulled away Republican support from Taft, and Wilson won the election with less than a majority vote. Wilson and Roosevelt campaigned vigorously against the evils of the Money Trust, while all along being dependent upon that same trust for campaign funding. When Wilson was elected, Colonel House literally moved into the White House and became the unseen President of the United States. Under his guidance, the Aldrich Bill was given cosmetic surgery and emerged as the Glass-Owen Bill. Although sponsored by Democrats, in all essential features it was still the Jekyll Island plan. Aldrich, Vanderlip, and others identified with Wall Street put on a pretense of opposing the Glass-Owen Bill to convince Congress and the public that big bankers were fearful of it. The final bill was written with many sound features which were included to make it palatable during congressional debate, but which were pre-designed to be dropped in later years. To win the support of the populists under the leadership of William Jennings Bryan, the Jekyll Island team also engineered what appeared to be compromises, but which in actual operation were, as Wilson called them, mere shadows, while the substance remained. In short, Congress was outflanked, outfoxed, and outclassed by a deceptive but brilliant psychopolitical attack. The result is that on December 23, 1913, America once again had a central bank. Chapter 23. The Great Duck Dinner. How Federal Reserve policies led to the crash of 1929. The expansion of the money supply as a means of helping the economy of England. The resulting wave of speculation in stocks and real estate. Evidence that the Federal Reserve Board had foreknowledge of the crash and even executed the events that were designed to trigger it. The story is told of a New England farmer with a small pond in his pasture. Each summer a group of wild ducks would frequent that pond, but try as he would, the farmer could never catch one. No matter how early in the morning he approached, or how carefully he constructed a blind, or what kind of duck call he tried, somehow those crafty birds sensed the danger and managed to be out of range. Of course, when fall arrived, the ducks headed south, and the farmer's craving for a duck dinner only intensified. Then he got an idea. Early in the spring, he started scattering corn along the edge of the pond. The ducks liked the corn, and since it was always there, they soon gave up dipping and foraging for food of their own. After a while, they became used to the farmer and began to trust him. They could see he was their benefactor, and they now walked close to him with no sense of fear. Life was so easy, they forgot how to fly. But that was unimportant, because they were now so fat they couldn't have gotten off the water even if they had tried. Fall came, and the ducks stayed. Winter came, and the pond froze. The farmer built a shelter to keep them warm. The ducks were happy because they didn't have to fly. And the farmer was especially happy, because each week, all winter long, he had a delicious duck dinner. That is the story of America's Great Depression of the 1930s. Consolidation of power. When the Federal Reserve Act was submitted to Congress, many of its most important features were written in vague language. Some details were omitted entirely. That was a tactical move to avoid debate over fine points and to allow flexibility for future interpretation. The goal was to get the bill passed and perfect it later. Since then, the Act has been amended 195 times, expanding the power and scope of the system to the point where today it would be almost unrecognizable to the congressmen and senators who voted for it. In 1913, public distaste for concentration of financial power in the hands of a few Wall Street banks helped to fuel the fire for passage of the Federal Reserve Act. To make it appear that the new system would put an end to the New York Money Trust, as it was called, the public was told that the Federal Reserve would not represent any one group or one region. Instead, it would have its power diffused over 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, and none would be able to dominate. As Galbraith pointed out, however, the regional design was admirable for serving local pride and architectural ambition and for lulling the suspicions of the agrarians. But that was not what the planners had in mind for the long haul. In the beginning, the regional branches took their autonomy seriously, and that led to conflict with members of the national board. The Board of Governors was composed of political appointees representing diverse segments of the economy. They were outclassed by the heads of the regional branches of the system, who were bankers, with bankers' experience.
You have reached the end of Disc 16.
Return of the New York Money Trust. The greatest power struggle arose from the New York Reserve Bank, which was headed by Benjamin Strong. Strong had the contacts and the experience. It will be recalled that he was one of the seven who drafted the cartel's structure at Jekyll Island. He had been the head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company and was closely associated with Edward Mandel House. He had become a personal friend of Montague Norman, head of the Bank of England, and of Charles Riest, head of the Bank of France. Not least of all, he was head of the New York branch of the system, which represented the nation's largest banks, the Money Trust itself. From the outset, the National Board and the regional branches were dominated by the New York branch. Strong ruled as an autocrat, determining Fed policy often without even consulting with the Federal Reserve Board in Washington. The United States' entry into World War I provided the impetus for increasing the power of the Fed. The system became the sole fiscal agent of the Treasury, Federal Reserve notes were issued, virtually all of the gold reserves of the nation's commercial banks were gathered together into the vaults of the federal system, and many of the legislative restraints placed into the original act were abandoned. Voters ask fewer questions when their nation is at war. The concentration of power into the hands of the very money trust the Fed was supposed to defeat is described by Ferdinand Lundberg, author of America's 60 Families. In practice, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York became the fountainhead of the system of 12 regional banks, for New York was the money market of the nation. The other 11 banks were so many expensive mausoleums erected to salve the local pride and quell the Jacksonian fears of the hinterland. Benjamin Strong, president of the Bankers Trust Company, J.P. Morgan, was selected as the first governor of the New York Reserve Bank. An adept in high finance, Strong for many years manipulated the country's monetary system at the discretion of directors representing the leading New York banks. Under Strong, the reserve system, unsuspected by the nation, was brought into interlocking relations with the Bank of England and the Bank of France. Bailing out Europe. It will be recalled from chapters 12 and 20 that it was this interlock during World War I that was responsible for the confiscation from American taxpayers of billions of dollars which were given to the central banks of England and France. Much of that money found its way to the associates of J.P. Morgan as interest payments on war bonds and as fees for supplying munitions and other war materials. 70% of the cost of World War I was paid by inflation rather than taxes, a process that was orchestrated by the Federal Reserve System. This was considered by the Fed's supporters as its first real test, and it passed with flying colors. American inflation during that period was only slightly less than in England, which had been more deeply committed to war and for a longer period of time. That is not surprising, inasmuch as a large portion of Europe's war costs had been transferred to the American taxpayers. After the war was over, The transfusion of American dollars continued as part of a plan to pull England out of depression. The methods chosen for that transfer were artificially low interest rates and a deliberate inflation of the American money supply. That was calculated to weaken the value of the dollar relative to the English pound and cause gold reserves to move from America to England. Both operations were directed by Benjamin Strong and executed by the Federal Reserve. It was not hyperbole when President Herbert Hoover described Strong as a mental annex to Europe. Before Alan Greenspan was appointed as chairman of the Federal Reserve by President Reagan in 1987, he had served on the board of the J.P. Morgan Company. Before that, however, he had been an outspoken champion of the gold standard and a critic of the system's subservience to the banking cartel. In 1966, he wrote, "When business in the United States underwent a mild contraction in 1927, the Federal Reserve created more paper reserves in the hope of forestalling any possible bank reserve shortage. More disastrous, however, was the Federal Reserve's attempt to assist Great Britain, who had been losing gold to us. The Fed succeeded. It stopped the gold loss, but it nearly destroyed the economies of the world in the process. The excess credit which the Fed pumped into the economy spilled over into the stock market, triggering a fantastic speculative boom. As a result, the American economy collapsed." After his appointment to the Fed, Greenspan became silent on these issues and did nothing to anger the creature he now served. Agents of a Higher Power. When reviewing this aspect of the Fed's history, questions arise about the patriotic loyalty of men like Benjamin Strong. How is it possible for a man who enjoys the best that his nation can offer, security, wealth, prestige, to conspire to plunder his fellow citizens in order to assist politicians of other governments to continue plundering theirs? The first part of the answer was illustrated in earlier sections of this book. International money managers may be citizens of a particular country, but to many of them, that is a meaningless accident of birth. They consider themselves to be citizens of the world first. They speak of affection for all mankind, but their highest loyalty is to themselves and their profession. That is only half the answer. It must be remembered that the men who pulled the financial levers on this doomsday machine, the governors of the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve, were themselves tied to strings which were pulled by others above them. Their minds were not obsessed with the concepts of nationalism or even internationalism. Their loyalties were to men. Professor Quigley reminds us, "It must not be felt that these heads of the world's chief central banks were themselves substantive powers in world finance. They were not. Rather, they were the technicians and agents of the dominant investment bankers of their own countries, who had raised them up and were perfectly capable of throwing them down. The substantive financial powers of the world were in the hands of these investment bankers, also called international or merchant bankers, who remained largely behind the scenes in their own unincorporated private banks. These formed a system of international cooperation and national dominance which was more private, more powerful, and more secret than that of their agents in the central banks." So we are not dealing with the actions of men who perceive themselves as betraying their nation, but technicians who are loyal to the monetary scientists and the political scientists who raise them up. Of the two groups, the financiers are dominant. Politicians come and go, but those who wield the power of money remain to pick their successors. Farmers become duck dinner. During the war, prices for agricultural products rose to an all-time high, and so did profits. Farmers had put part of that money into war bonds, but much of it had been placed into savings accounts at banks within the farming communities, which is to say mostly in the Midwest and South. That was unacceptable to the New York banks, which saw their share of the nation's deposits begin to decline. A way had to be devised to reclaim that money. The Federal Reserve System, which by then was the captive of the New York banks, was pressed into service to accomplish the deed. Few of those country banks had chosen to become members of the Federal Reserve System. That added insult to injury, and it also provided an excuse for the Fed to wage economic war against them. The plan was neither complex nor original. It had been used many times before by central bankers. It was, 1. Extend easy credit to the farmers to lure them into heavy debt, and then, 2. Create a recession which would decrease their income to the point where they could not make payments. The country banks would then find themselves holding non-performing loans and foreclosed property, which they could not sell without tremendous losses. In the end, both the farmers and the banks would be wiped out. The banks were the target. Too bad about the farmers. Congressman Charles Lindbergh Sr., father of the man who made the world's first solo transatlantic flight, explained it this way. Under the Federal Reserve Act, panics are scientifically created. The present panic is the first scientifically created one, worked out as we figure a mathematical problem. The details of how this panic was created were explained in 1939 by former Senator Robert Owen, chairman of the Senate Banking and Currency Committee. Owen, a banker himself, had been a co-author of the Federal Reserve Act, a role he later regretted. Owen said, "In May 1920, the farmers were exceedingly prosperous. They were paying off their mortgages. They had bought a lot of new land at the instance of the government, had borrowed money to do it, and then they were bankrupted by a sudden contraction of credit and currency, which took place in 1920. The Federal Reserve Board met in a meeting which was not disclosed to the public. They met on the 18th of May 1920. It was a secret meeting, and they spent all day. The minutes made 60 printed pages, and it appears in Senate Document 310 of February 10, 1923. Under action taken by the Federal Reserve Board on May 18, 1920, there resulted a violent contraction of credit. This contraction of credit and currency had the effect, the next year, of diminishing the national production $15 billion. It had the effect of throwing millions of people out of employment. It had the effect of reducing the value of lands and ranches $20 billion. The contraction of credit had a disastrous effect on the nation as a whole, not just farmers. But the farmers were more deeply involved because the recently created Federal Farm Loan Board had lured them with easy credit, like ducks at the pond, into extreme debt ratios. Furthermore, the large city banks, which were members of the system, were given support by the Fed during the summer of 1920 to enable them to extend credit to manufacturers and merchants. That allowed many of them to ride out the slump. There was no such support for the farmers or the country banks, which, by 1921, were falling like dominoes. History books refer to this event as the Agricultural Depression of 1920 and 21. A better name would have been Country Duck Dinner in New York. Building the Mandrake Mechanism. In Chapter 10, we examined the three methods by which the Federal Reserve is able to create or extinguish money. Of the three, the purchase and sale of debt-related securities in the open market is the one that provides the greatest effect on the money supply. The purchase of securities by the Fed, with checks that have no money to back them, creates money. The sale of those securities extinguishes money. Although the Fed is authorized to buy and sell almost any kind of security that exists in the world, it is obligated to show preference for bonds and notes of the federal government. That is the way the monetary scientists discharge the commitment to create money for their partners, the political scientists. Without that service, the partnership would dissolve, and Congress would abolish the Fed. When the system was created in 1913, it was anticipated that the primary way to manipulate the money supply would be to control the reserve ratios and the discount window. That is banker language for setting the level of mandatory bank reserves as a percentage of deposits, and also setting the interest rate on loans made by the Fed to the banks themselves. The reserve ratio under the old National Bank Act had been 25%. Under the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, it was reduced to 18% for the large New York banks, a drop of 28%. In 1917, just 4 years later, the reserve requirements for Central Reserve City banks were further dropped from 18% to 13%, with slightly lesser reductions for smaller banks. That was an additional 28% cut. It quickly became apparent that setting reserve ratios was an inefficient tool. The latitude of control was too small, and the amount of public attention too great. The second method, influencing the interest rate on commercial loans, was more useful. Here is how that works. Under a fractional reserve banking system, a bank can create new money merely by issuing a loan. The amount it creates is limited by the reserve ratio, or fraction, it is required to maintain to cover its cash flow needs. If the reserve ratio is 10%, then each $10 it lends includes $9 that never existed before. A commercial bank, therefore, can create a sizable amount of money merely by making loans. But once the bank is loaned up, that is to say, once it has already lent $9 for every $1 it holds in reserve, it must stop and wait for some of the old loans to be paid back before it can issue new ones. The only way to expand that process is to make the reserves larger. That can be accomplished in one of four ways. 1. Attract more deposits. 2. Use some of the bank's profits. 3. Sell additional stock to investors. Or 4. Borrow money from the Fed. When banks borrow from the Fed. The fourth option is the most popular and is called going to the discount window. When banks go to the Fed's discount window to obtain a loan, they are expected to put up collateral. This can be almost any debt contract held by the bank, including government bonds, but it commonly consists of commercial loans. The Fed then grants credit to the bank in an amount equal to those contracts. In essence, this allows the bank to convert its old loans into new reserves. Every dollar of those new reserves then can be used as the basis for lending 9 more dollars in checkbook money. The process does not stop there. Once the new loans are made, they too can be used as collateral at the Fed for still more reserves. The music goes round and round, with each new level of debt becoming reserves for yet a higher level of loans, until it finally plays itself out at about 28 times. That process is commonly called discounting commercial paper. It was one of the means by which the Fed was able to flood the nation with new money prior to the Great Dam Rupture of 1929. But there is a problem with that method, at least as far as the Fed is concerned. Even though interest rates at the discount window can be made so low that most bankers will line up like ducks looking for free corn, some of them, particularly those hicks in the country banks, have been known to resist the temptation. There is no way to force the banks to participate. Furthermore, the banks themselves are dependent upon the whims of their customers who, for reasons known only to themselves, may not want to borrow as much as the bank wants to lend. If the customers stop borrowing, then the banks have no new loans to convert into further reserves. That left the third mechanism as the preferred option, the purchase and sale of bonds and other debt obligations in the open market. With the discount window, banks have to be enticed to borrow money, which later must be repaid, and sometimes they are reluctant to do that. But with the open market, all the Fed has to do is write a fiat check to pay for the securities. When that check is cashed, the new money it created moves directly into the economy without any concurrence required from the recalcitrant banks. But there was a problem with this method also. Before World War I, there were few government bonds available on the open market, Even after the war, the supply was limited. Which means the vast inflation that preceded the crash of 1929 was not caused by deficit spending. In each year from 1920 through 1930, there was a surplus of government revenue over expenses. Surprising as it may be, on the eve of the Depression, America was getting out of debt. As a consequence, there were few government bonds for the Fed to buy. Without government bonds, the open market engine was constantly running out of gas. The solution to all these problems was to create a new market tailor-made to the Fed's needs, a kind of halfway house between the discount window and the open market. It was called the acceptance window, and it was through that imagery that the system purchased a unique type of debt-related security called bankers' acceptances. Bankers' acceptances. Bankers' acceptances are contracts promising payment for commercial goods scheduled for later delivery. They usually involve international trade, where delays of 3 to 6 months are common. They are a means by which a seller in one country can ship goods to an unknown buyer in another country with confidence that he will be paid upon delivery. That is accomplished through guarantees made by the banks of both buyer and seller. First, the buyer's bank issues a letter of credit guaranteeing payment for the goods, even if the buyer should default. When the seller's bank receives this, one of its officers writes the word accepted on the contract and pays the seller the amount of the sale. The accepting bank, therefore, advances the money to the seller in expectation of receiving future payment from the buyer's bank. For this service, both banks charge a fee expressed as a percentage of the contract. Thus, the buyer pays a little more than the amount of the sales contract, and the seller receives a little less. Historically, these contracts have been safe because the banks are careful to guarantee payment only for financially sound firms. But in times of economic panic, even sound firms may be unable to honor their contracts. It was underwriting that kind of business that nearly bankrupted George Peabody and J.P. Morgan in London during the Panic of 1857, and would have done so had they not been bailed out by the Bank of England. Acceptances, like commercial loan contracts, are negotiable instruments that can be traded in the securities market. The accepting banks have a choice of holding them until maturity or selling them. If they hold them, their profit will be realized when the underlying contract is eventually paid off, and it will be equal to the amount of its discount, which is banker language for its fee. Acceptances are said to be rediscounted when they are sold by the original discounter, the underwriter. The advantage of doing that is that they do not have to wait 3 to 6 months for their profit. They can acquire immediate capital, which can be invested to earn interest. The sale price of an acceptance is always less than the value of the underlying contracts, otherwise no one would buy them. The difference represents the potential profit to the buyer. It is expressed as a percentage and is called the rate of discount, or in this case, rediscount. But the rate given by the seller must be lower than what he expects to earn with the money he receives, otherwise he will be better off not selling. Although bankers' acceptances were commonly traded in Europe, they were not popular in the United States. Before the Federal Reserve Act was passed, national banks had been prohibited from purchasing them. A market, therefore, had to be created. The Fed accomplished this by setting the discount rate on acceptances so low that underwriters would have been foolish not to take advantage of it. At a very low discount, they could acquire short-term funds, which then could be invested at a higher rate of return. Thus, acceptances quickly became plentiful on the open market in the United States. But who would want to buy them at a low return? No one, of course. So, to create that market, not only did the Federal Reserve set the discount rate artificially low, it also pledged to buy all of the acceptances that were offered. The Fed, therefore, became the principal buyer of these securities. Banks also came into the market as buyers, but only because they knew that at any time they wanted to sell, the Fed was pledged to buy. Since the money was being created out of nothing, the cost did not really matter, nor did the low profit potential. The Fed's goal was not to make a profit on investment, it was to increase the nation's money supply. Warburg and friends make a little profit. The man who benefited most from this artificially created market was none other than Paul Warburg, a partner with Kuhn Loeb and Company. Warburg was in attendance at the Jekyll Island meeting at which the Federal Reserve System was conceived. He was considered by all to have been the master theoretician who led the others in their deliberations. He was one of the most influential voices in the public debates that followed. He had been appointed as one of the first members of the Federal Reserve Board, and later became its vice-governor until outbreak of war, at which time he resigned because of publicity regarding his connections with German banking. He was a director of American IG, Chemical Corp, and Agfa Ansco Incorporated, firms that were controlled by IG Farben, the infamous German cartel that only a few years later would sponsor the rise to power of Adolf Hitler. He was also a director of the CFR, Council on Foreign Relations. It should not be surprising, therefore, to learn that he was able to position himself at the center of the huge cash flow resulting from the Fed's purchase of acceptances. Warburg was the founder and chairman of the International Acceptance Bank of New York, the world's largest acceptance bank. He was also a director of several smaller competitors, including the prestigious Westinghouse Acceptance Bank. He was founder and chairman of the American Acceptance Council. Warburg was the acceptance market in America. But he was not without friends who also swam in the river of money. Men who controlled America's largest financial institutions became directors or officers of the various acceptance banks. The list of companies that became part of the interlocking directorate included Kuhn Loeb and Company, New York Trust Company, Bank of Manhattan Trust Company, American Trust Company, New York Title and Mortgage Company, Chase National Bank, Metropolitan Life Insurance Company, American Express Company, the Carnegie Corporation, Guarantee Trust Company, Mutual Life Insurance Company, the Equitable Life Assurance Society of New York, and the First National Banks of Boston, St. Louis, and Los Angeles, to name just a few. The world of acceptance banking was the private domain of the financial elite of Wall Street. Behind the American image, however, was a full partnership with investors from Europe. Total capital of the IAB's American shareholders was $276 million compared with $271 million from foreign investors. A significant portion of that was divided between the Warburgs in Germany and the Rothschilds in England. Just how large and free-flowing was that river of acceptance money? In 1929, it was $1.7 trillion wide. Throughout the 1920s, it was over half of all the new money created by the Federal Reserve, greater than all the other purchases on the open market, plus all the loans to all the banks standing in line at the discount window. The monetary scientists who created the Federal Reserve and their close business associates were well rewarded for their efforts. Profit-taking by insiders, however, is not the issue. Far more important is the fact that the consequence of this self-serving mechanism was the massive expansion of the money supply that made the Great Depression inevitable. And that is the topic which impelled us to look at acceptances in the first place. Congress, suspicious but afraid to tinker. By 1920, suspicions and resentment were growing in the halls of Congress. Politicians were not getting their share. It is possible that many of them failed to realize that as partners in the scheme, they were entitled to a share. Nevertheless, they were dazzled by banker language and accounting tricks, and were afraid to tinker with the system lest they accidentally push the wrong button. Watching with amusement from London was Fabian socialist John Maynard Keynes. Speaking of the Federal Reserve's manipulation of the value of the dollar, he wrote, "That is the way by which a rich country is able to combine new wisdom with old prejudice. It can enjoy the latest scientific improvements devised in the economic laboratory of Harvard, whilst leaving Congress to believe that no rash departure will be permitted. But there is, in all such fictions, a certain instability. The suspicions of congressmen may be aroused. One cannot be quite certain that some senator might not read and understand this book." There was not much danger of that. By then, American politicians had acquired a taste for the heady wine of war funding and stopped asking questions. World War I had created enormous demands for money, and the Fed provided it. By the end of the war, congressional hostility to the Federal Reserve became history. Paying for World War I. Much of the war debt was absorbed by the public, which responded to patriotic instincts and purchased war bonds. The Treasury launched a massive publicity campaign for Liberty Loans to reinforce that sentiment. These small denomination bonds did not expand the money supply and did not cause inflation because the money came from savings. It already existed. However, many people who thought it was their patriotic duty to support the war effort went to their banks and borrowed money so they could buy bonds. The bank created most of that money out of nothing, drawing upon credits and bookkeeping entries from the Federal Reserve, so those purchases did inflate the money supply. The same result could have been obtained more simply and less expensively by getting the money directly from the Fed, but the government encouraged the trend anyway because of its psychological value in generating popular support for the war. When people make sacrifices for an endeavor, it reinforces their belief that it must be worthy. Although the war was financed partly by taxes and partly by liberty bonds purchased by the public, a significant portion was covered by the sale of Treasury bonds to the Federal Reserve in the open market. Benjamin Strong's biographer, Lester Chandler, explains. "The Federal Reserve system became an integral part of the war financing machinery. The system's overriding objective, both as a creator of money and as fiscal agent, was to ensure that the Treasury would be supplied with all the money it needed and on terms fixed by Congress and the Treasury. A grateful nation now hailed it as a major contributor to the winning of the war, an efficient fiscal agent for the Treasury, a great source of currency and reserve funds, and a permanent and indispensable part of the banking system." The emergence of government debt. The war years were largely a period of testing new strategies and consolidating power. Ironically, it was not until after the war, when there was no longer a justification for deficit spending, that government debt became plentiful. Up until World War I, annual federal expenses had been running about $750 million. By the end of the war, it was running $18.5 billion, an increase of 2,466%. Approximately 70% of the cost of the war had been financed by debt. Murray Rothbard reminds us that on the eve of depression in 1928, 10 years after the end of the war, the banking system held more government bonds than during the war itself. That means the government did not pay off those bonds when they came due. Instead, it rolled them over by offering new bonds to replace the old. Why? Was it because Congress needed more money? No. The bonds had become the basis for money in circulation, and if they had been redeemed, the money supply would have decreased. A decrease in the money supply is viewed by politicians and central bankers as a threat to economic stability. Thus, the government found itself unable to get out of debt even when it had the money to do so, a dilemma that continues to this day. There is an apparent contradiction here. In his book, The Great Boom and Panic, Robert Patterson says that on the eve of depression, America was getting out of debt. Yet Rothbard tells us there were more government bonds held by the banking system than during the war. The only way both statements can be true is if there were in fact more bonds outstanding during the war, but they were held by the public, not by the banking system. That would make it possible for there to be fewer total bonds in 1928, and yet the system could still hold more of them than previously. That would be the expected result of the Fed's growing role in the open market. As the publicly held bonds matured, the Treasury rolled them over, and the Fed picked them up. Bonds purchased by the public do not increase the money supply, whereas those purchased by banks do. Therefore, conditions in 1928 would have been far more inflationary than during the war, even though the government was getting out of debt. Before 1922, the Federal Reserve bought Treasury bonds primarily for three purposes. One, for income to operate the system. Two, to pay for the newly issued Federal Reserve notes, which were replacing silver certificates. And three, to push down interest rates. The motive for manipulating interest rates was to encourage borrowing from abroad in the United States, where rates were low. It also encouraged investment from the United States into Europe, where rates were higher. By making it possible to borrow American dollars at one rate and invest them elsewhere at a higher rate, the Fed was deliberately moving money out of the United States, with gold reserves following behind. As President Kennedy said in his 1963 address at the IMF, the outflow of American gold did not come about by chance. The discovery of the open market. It is commonly asserted by writers on this topic that the power of the open market mechanism to manipulate the money supply was discovered by the Fed in the early 1920s, and that it came as a total surprise. Martin Mayer, for example, in his book The Bankers, writes, "Now, through an accident as startling as those which produced the discovery of X-rays or penicillin, the central bank learned that open market operations could have a significant effect on the behavior of the banks." This makes the story interesting, but it is difficult to believe that Benjamin Strong, Paul Warburg, Montague Norman, and the other monetary scientists who were pulling the levers at that time were taken by surprise. These men could not possibly have been ignorant of the effect of creating money out of nothing and pouring it into the economy. The open market was merely a different funnel. If there was any element of surprise, it likely was only in the ease with which the mechanism could be activated. It is not important whether that part of the story is fact or fiction, except that it perpetuates the accidental view of history, the myth that no one is responsible for political or economic chaos. Things just happen. There was no master plan. No one is to blame. Everything is under control. Relax, pay your taxes, and go back to sleep. In any event, by the end of the war, Congress had awakened to the fact that it could use the Federal Reserve System to obtain revenue without taxes. From that point forward, deficit spending became institutionalized. A gradually increasing issuance of Treasury bonds was encouraging to the Fed because it provided still one more source of debt to convert into money, a source that eventually would become far more reliable than either bank loans or bankers' acceptances. Best of all, now that Congress was becoming dependent on the free corn, there was little chance it would find its wings and fly away. The more dependent it became, the more secure the system itself became. In 1921, the 12 regional reserve banks were separately buying and selling in the open market. But motives varied. Some merely needed income to cover their operating overhead, while others, notably the New York branch under Benjamin Strong, were more interested in sending American gold to England. Strong began immediately to gather control of all open market operations into the hands of his own bank. In June of 1922, the Open Market Committee was formed to coordinate activities among the regional governors. In April of the next year, however, The National Board in Washington replaced the governor's group with one of its own creation, the Open Market Investments Committee. Benjamin Strong was its chairman. The powers of that group were enhanced 10 years later by legislation which made it mandatory for the regional branches to follow the Open Market Committee's directives. But that was a mere formality, for the die had been cast.